14. The Second Disinformation Operation, the Evolution of the Soviet Regime, Part 1. The Major Changes in the USSR. Certain developments in the Soviet Union since 1958 have been widely interpreted in the West as reflecting a moderation in the rigors of communist ideology and a decline in its influence over the practical handling of affairs of state. These apparent trends are usually thought of as being associated with the growth of the Soviet Union into a great power, increasingly pursuing its national interests along traditional lines and facing familiar internal political problems. In particular, the emergence of a dissident movement. While it is true that changes have been made in various economic, political, diplomatic, and ideological aspects of the regime, a distinction must be made between the changes themselves and the manner in which they have been presented if the nature and purpose of disinformation about them is to be understood. Economic changes. From the late 1950s onward, changes in Soviet economic practice included the improvement of material incentives to production in industry and agriculture, the promotion of competition, and the broadening of the private market in the cities. Sensational evidence suggesting the revival of capitalism appeared in the Soviet press in the form of articles on the black market and on underground capitalists in the Soviet Union. The Confessions of a Former Soviet Underground Millionaire appeared in Izvestia in 1959 or 1960. It is true that there is, and, on a varying scale, always has been a private market in the Soviet Union in which collectivized peasants and some private individuals have sold the agricultural produce grown on their lots. In the NEP period, when private ownership and private enterprise were permitted, this private market reached its post-revolutionary zenith. With the ending of the NEP and the collectivization of agriculture, it shrank to insignificant proportions. During and after the Second World War, it revived again for a short period, only to be drastically curtailed in the last years of Stalin's rule. Since his death, with the new emphasis on incentives and the abolition of deliveries of goods to the state by farmers from their private lots, the private market has once more grown in scale. It now exists in two principal forms: the main market, in the cities where collective farmers and some private individuals sell their agricultural produce, and a small black market, especially in Moscow and Leningrad, in which illegal transactions in currency and goods take place between Soviet speculators and foreign diplomats and visitors. The growth of the main market has been strictly limited because the introduction of greater incentives for farmers and other workers was not accompanied by the legalization of private enterprises. The emphasis throughout has been on increasing production and efficiency not in private enterprises, but in collective farms and state-owned industries and trading enterprises. There can be no significant widening of the private market and healthy competition with the state sector unless private ownership and enterprise are reintroduced. The Soviet government shows no sign of doing this. On the contrary, the regime maintains its hostile attitude to private ownership, and the ultimate objective of party policy is still the total extinction of the private sector. As for the black market, it is, as foreign diplomats know, extremely limited and illegal. What is less widely known is that it is secretly controlled and actively exploited by the Anti-Contraband Department of the KGB. Significantly, this department was created in 1959 on the lines of a similar department set up in the GPU during the NEP period. Its function is to control the activities of domestic speculators and foreign businessmen and to blackmail and recruit as agents members of the diplomatic colony and other foreign visitors who engage in illicit transactions. The head of this new department, Sergei Mikhailovich Fedosiev, was so successful in recruiting foreigners, including Americans, that in 1961 he was promoted to be chief of the American department, responsible for the recruitment of officials of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Tendencies toward private enterprise have existed in the Soviet Union since the revolution. Arrests of embezzlers and speculators who have enriched themselves at state expense have not always been reported. If in the period 1959-62 such arrests were given wide publicity, this did not indicate, as some Western observers believed and as the Soviet regime wished them to believe, that capitalism in the Soviet Union was reviving. On the contrary, it indicated that the regime was stepping up its traditional ideological policy of eliminating the remnants of capitalism, while at the same time promoting the myth that capitalism was being restored. Since the end of the 1950s, a measure of industrial reorganization has been in progress. Greater powers of initiative have been given to local economic management without weakening central control. Local councils of people's economy have been created. The authority of economic officials has been enhanced. In Western terminology, these officials are described as technocrats, who were said to be increasingly taking over control. But what Western observers largely ignore is that these so-called technocrats are in reality party members who, having received industrial or other specialized training, are applying the party line in their place of work. Through them, the party exercises a more efficient control over Soviet industry, which, despite the appearance of recent changes, is now more comprehensively planned and more effectively coordinated than before. From 1962 onward, there was a protracted debate in the official Soviet press on the introduction of the profit motive, on the concept of a market-regulated economy, and on the creation of a trust system in industry. The Soviet economist Professor Lieberman played a prominent role in the debate. Point one, according to Lieberman, factories should be given no more than basic production plans, which should be based mainly on commercial orders. Within the framework of the basic plan, factories should be free to determine their own wages, costs, and profits. A proportion of the profits should be paid into an incentive fund, which would pay bonuses to managers and workers. The introduction of state trusts that would function on a profit basis was encouraged by the government. In fact, some trusts of this kind were created from 1962 onward. For example, small shoe factories were combined experimentally into one complex in the Firm Progress in Lvov, and other trusts were set up in Gorky and elsewhere. The resemblance of these reforms to capitalism is only superficial. Their effect has been to strengthen, not to weaken, party control over industry. The fundamental differences between the Soviet and capitalist systems in their basic objectives, their principles of ownership and management, and the distribution of national income and political power remain. The emphasis in the Soviet capital investment program is still on heavy industry and especially on armaments, including military satellites and nuclear missiles. It should be noted that the economic reforms reflected to some extent the experience of the NEP. Some of Lieberman's ideas, as well as the creation of trust in industry, were directly modeled on the NEP pattern, but in fact the changes of the 1960s were less far-reaching than those of the 1920s. Private ownership of enterprises was not reintroduced after 1960. Agriculture remained collectivized. Such reforms as were carried out in the 1960s and 1970s did not signal a fundamental change in the regime. They were carefully calculated steps taken by the regime within the framework of its long-range policy. Their object was not to change the nature of the system, but to stabilize it by making the economy more efficient and party control more effective. There are, in short, fewer objective grounds for concluding now that the economic nature of the regime has been evolving since 1960 in the direction of capitalism than there were in the NEP period. In the 1960s and 1970s, however, the same technique has been used as in the 1920s to exaggerate and misrepresent the nature of such changes as have occurred to suggest a weakening of ideological influence and a tendency toward the restoration of capitalism. The KGB has played an active part in this misrepresentation. For example, the confessions of an underground millionaire were supplied to Izvestia by the KGB at the personal instigation of Shelepin. A more widespread KGB technique has been used to influence directly the opinions of visiting Western tourists, businessmen, scholars, and correspondents. For instance, Western economists who visit the Soviet Union naturally wish to meet their Soviet colleagues. It is normal practice for the latter to clear such meetings in advance with the party and the KGB. They are then briefed on the line to be taken in frank discussions with their Western colleagues on the faults in the Soviet system and the direction in which it is evolving. Given that there has been no restoration of capitalism in the Soviet Union, Chinese and Albanian charges to this effect in their polemics with the Soviet leaders in the 1960s were unfounded and can therefore be seen as part and parcel of an agreed bloc disinformation effort carried out in accordance with the long-range policy. Decisions reached, with Chinese and Albanian participation, in the period 1958-60. Political changes. Western belief in a moderation in the Soviet attitude toward internal and external political problems during the 1960s was based on various changes introduced from 1958 onward. They can be briefly listed. A new formula was evolved to replace the dictatorship of the proletariat, in official communist language. This was the concept of the state of the whole people. Two certain legal changes were made. Steps were taken ostensibly to reduce the role and influence of the security service. The All-Union Ministry of Internal Affairs was abolished in 1959, but only for a short time. The chairman of the KGB, the notorious police professional General Ivan Serov, was dismissed on December 9, 1958. He was replaced 2 weeks later by the former leader of the Soviet youth movement and alleged liberal Shelepin. The use of terror was reduced. It was decreed that socialist legality should be observed. The KGB was represented as a reformed organization, hard on the enemies of the regime but humanistic in its approach to the Soviet people, as was its forerunner in Dzerzhinsky's days. Khrushchev told editors of the West German Social Democratic Press that state security organizations were not really needed at all in the Soviet Union. They could at most be used to deal with cases of petty larceny. Khrushchev and Shelepin repeatedly denied that there were political prisoners in the Soviet Union. Point 4. According to Communist, the state security organs are now laying more and more emphasis on preventive, educational work. They are expanding their prophylactic work. This line was in sharp contrast with the earlier emphasis on repression in the work of the security services. A more tolerant attitude was ostensibly adopted toward religion. The chairman of the Directorate for Affairs of the Orthodox Church, a KGB official named G. Karpov, was replaced by Kiroidov, a former secretary of a party provincial committee. More religious leaders were allowed to travel abroad. A more liberal attitude was adopted toward writers, scientists, and other creative workers. There were occasional, apparently independent and spontaneous, expressions of public opinion. Unofficial critical comments about the regime were sometimes published. While traditional socialist realism and art continued to receive official encouragement, well-publicized exhibitions of abstract painters were held in Moscow. They were roundly criticized by Khrushchev. As in painting, so in literature, alongside traditional hardline writing, certain well-known Soviet poets and authors published controversial material in the Soviet and foreign press. Some were harassed and punished in consequence. A Yevtushenko poem, including criticism of Stalin, was published in the Soviet Union. So was Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisevich, a description of life in a Soviet prison by an author who had himself been a prisoner under Stalin. Works by other former prisoners, such as Dyakov and Georgi Shelist, appeared in the early 1960s. More Soviet tourists traveled abroad, including writers who made critical and controversial comments about the regime. Some were allowed to leave the Soviet Union permanently. Within the Soviet Union, the well-known writer Kochetov emerged as the leader of the conservative wing of the Writers' Union, while the late poet Tvardovsky, who sponsored Solzhenitsyn's writings, led the liberals. The liberals were joined by the poets Yevtushenko and Voznesensky, also by prominent scientists and other dissidents. With the help of these apparently more liberal official attitudes, the image of the Soviet Union presented to the outside world was changed. The political fundamentals of the regime were not. The state of the whole people was still a dictatorship ruled exclusively, and now more effectively, by the Communist Party through the party apparatus and other organs, including the KGB. The KGB was still one of the pillars of the strength and stability of the regime. True anti-communist political opposition was suppressed as before, but on a selective basis. The real nature of the Soviet regime and the KGB and their intolerance of ideological opposition were demonstrated in October 1959 by the assassination in West Germany by the KGB of the Ukrainian nationalist leader, Stepan Bandera. The regime was no less ruthless inside the Soviet Union when dealing with nationalist or other opposition movements. Despite Khrushchev's disclaimers, political prisoners still existed, though their numbers were reduced. Political trials were normally still held in secret. The scale of repression cannot be judged by the show trials, which were sometimes publicized, or by information that, following the example of the 1920s, was sometimes leaked for political or tactical considerations through Samizdat and other sources. According to Mironov, its former chairman, the KGB branch in Leningrad in 1958-59 was still arresting 35% of the anti-Soviet elements it detected. The other 65% were let off with prophylactic warnings. Soviet intellectuals were still controlled officially through party organizations and the various institutes, academies, and writers, and other unions. Unofficially, they were still controlled by the security services through secret agents. There was no free, independent, spontaneous expression of political views in the Soviet Union. Although the use of terror was diminished in comparison with Stalin's time, true reform went no further than in the thaw between 1953 and 1956. The so-called political evolution of the regime can be understood in the light of Shelepin's secret report as the implementation of the long-range policy of stabilizing and strengthening the regime by adopting the methods used with success in the 1920s. The policy entailed not diminishing the power of the KGB, but giving it a wider, more active, sophisticated, and influential political role in shaping and conditioning the life of society. The statements by Khrushchev and others quoted above on the reduction in the KGB's importance were untrue and are in themselves evidence of the deliberate creation of a false image of Soviet society. The KGB itself participated with the party and the Soviet leadership in the creation of this false image. Prominent Soviet legal experts, including several from the KGB Institute like Professor of Law Viktor Chikvats, helped the Soviet leaders to formulate the new concept of the state of the whole people. They also helped to prepare the false statements quoted above on the restricted role of the KGB and the non-existence of political prisoners. When the puzzled staff and students at the KGB Institute, including the author, pointed out the inaccuracy of Khrushchev's remarks and asked for an explanation, they were told that such statements were required for political and tactical considerations. In fact, the statements were made in order to mask the KGB's new role. Further evidence of the role of the KGB in shaping the new, false image of the regime, evidence that illustrates the linkage and technique between the NEP period and the 1960s, can be found in the case of Shulgin. Shulgin was a former monarchist emigre leader who became a victim of the OGPU's trust and unwittingly was used by the OGPU to influence Western views on Soviet evolution. In September 1925, he was lured by the trust into the Soviet Union, and under trust auspices visited Kiev, Moscow, and Leningrad, meeting the defense, foreign affairs, and finance ministers of the trust's underground organization. In 1927, he wrote a book about his visit to the Soviet Union entitled Three Cities. After clearance with the trust, in effect, with the OGPU, the book was published outside the Soviet Union. One of its main themes was that foreign intervention in Soviet affairs was superfluous, since communism was a declining force. After the Second World War, Soviet security agents arrested Shulgin in Belgrade. He was imprisoned in the Soviet Union for his involvement with the trust in the 1920s. In 1960, he was released from prison and was used by the KGB, this time wittingly, to publish a brochure in which he stated some of the reasons for suggesting that the Soviet regime was evolving toward a more tolerant and democratic system. Changes in diplomacy. From 1958 onward, the Soviet leadership laid special emphasis on peaceful coexistence, trade and economic relations with the West, and a moderate and businesslike approach to negotiations and agreements. Soviet diplomacy entered an active phase. Top-level personal diplomacy became normal practice. Khrushchev and other Soviet leaders visited the United States and France. Western leaders were invited to the Soviet Union. Approaches were made to the governments of advanced capitalist countries, including Great Britain, the United States, West Germany, France, and Japan, for the purpose of improving political, economic, and cultural relations with them. The Soviets showed interest in summit conferences and international meetings on disarmament and trade. On December 4, 1958, the Soviets issued a declaration on the cessation of nuclear tests. Preceded and followed by other proposals on disarmament. 7. The Soviets expressed a desire to obtain capital equipment from the industrially advanced non-communist world on the basis of long-term credits. 8. Countries bordering on the Soviet Union received special attention. 9. In May 1962, Khrushchev suggested a world conference on trade. These initiatives did not represent an evolution toward a less ideological and more conventional national form of diplomacy on the part of the Soviet government. They should be compared with Soviet diplomacy under Lenin during the NEP. They were similar calculated steps taken on the basis and within the framework of a long-range ideological policy. Similar emphasis on peaceful coexistence and businesslike relations with the capitalist world and a similar use of high-level contacts with non-communist governments can be seen in Soviet diplomacy leading up to the Genoa Conference of 1922. This was a period in which Lenin himself advocated the use of moderate language, avoiding in particular words suggesting that violence and terror played any part in Soviet tactics. The Soviet government's proposals to the UN General Assembly on full and complete disarmament and the call for a world conference on trade are even more strikingly similar to Soviet proposals in the 1920s. The so-called moderate Soviet diplomacy of the 1960s was a repetition of Lenin's activist foreign policy of gaining specific benefits for the Soviet Union by exploiting the contradictions within and between non-communist countries. If this historical basis for Soviet diplomacy in the 1960s is taken into account together with Lenin's pamphlet, Left-Wing Communism, and Infantile Disorder, it is easier to understand why the emphasis on coexistence and business-like cooperation between states with different social systems in the 1960s was accompanied by an intensification of the ideological struggle inside and outside the Soviet Union. Khrushchev's calls for peaceful coexistence and disarmament were combined with outspoken attacks on capitalism and predictions of upheavals in the West, which were made during and after his visits to the United States in 1959 and 1960.10. Even more important was the intensification of support for revolutionary and national liberation movements abroad, most conspicuously in Vietnam and Africa. The year 1960 saw the foundation in the Soviet Union of a new university, Lumumba University, intended for the training of revolutionary leaders for the developing countries of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The resemblance between Soviet initiatives in the 1920s and those in the late 1950s and early 1960s did not escape the notice of all Western analysts. For example, David M. Absher, in his contribution to the book Détente, said that more striking than any adjustment currently being made to meet changing conditions was the adjustment of the NEP in the 1920s.11 Similarly, Lazar Pishtrak, in his book The Grand Tactician, observed that Khrushchev had resumed Lenin's methods of an active foreign policy in the simultaneous spreading of world revolutionary ideas by means of unprecedented propaganda devices. 12. A third Western observer, G. A. Vaughan Stackelberg, pointed out the inconsistency between peaceful coexistence and the foundation of a university for training revolutionary leaders for the Third World. He drew a direct comparison between Lumumba University and the Communist University of the Toilers of the East, set up almost 40 years earlier under Lenin to train cadres for the Eastern Soviet republics of Turkestan, Kazakhstan, and the Caucasus. As he pointed out, it could also be compared with the Sun Yat-sen University, which trained cadres for the communist revolution in China. 13. Despite the talk of peaceful coexistence, Soviet policy provoked or contributed to a series of crises in the decade following 1958, including the Berlin Crisis of November 1958, when Khrushchev proposed to terminate the city's occupied status, the U-2 crisis in 1960, which Khrushchev used to wreck the summit conference, the Soviet decision to resume nuclear testing in 1961, the Cuban crisis of 1962, and the Middle East crisis of 1967. Again, the explanation is to be found in the experience of the NEP and the Leninist view of foreign policy as a form of ideological struggle in which both peaceful and non-peaceful methods should be used. Peaceful coexistence was defined under Khrushchev, as it was under Lenin, as a form of class struggle between antagonistic social systems based on the active exploitation of the contradictions within and between non-communist countries. 14. The revival of an active Leninist foreign policy was confirmed. For example, in the Soviet military newspaper Krasnaya Zvezda on July 18, 1963, in an article that stated, "The Leninist foreign policy carried out by the Central Committee of the CPSU and the Soviet government is a high-principled, flexible, active policy always on the offensive. It has fully justified itself and is bearing excellent fruit. Communists do not keep it a secret that coexistence is necessary for worldwide victory of Marxist-Leninist ideas, that there are deep-rooted differences between the two world systems of socialism and capitalism. To solve those differences, Marxist-Leninists hold, war is not an obligatory means in economic, political, and ideological struggle." Soviet foreign policy in the 1960s was not moderate. It was more offensive than in the years preceding and following Stalin's death, when the crisis of the regime forced it onto the defensive. The notion that it was more moderate, more conventional, more nationalist, and less ideological is the product of deliberate disinformation and the systematic use of terms, such as peaceful coexistence, that are themselves intentionally misleading. The Soviet intelligence and security services played their part in misrepresenting the nature of Soviet foreign policy, in particular by projecting and underlining the common interests between communist and non-communist countries. The participation of prominent Soviet agents of influence in the scientific field, like academician Topchiev, and the role they played in Pugwash and other conferences, recall the use of the Eurasian movement by Dzerzhinsky in the 1920s. Chinese and Albanian accusations that the Soviet regime had departed from Leninist principles of revolutionary policy contributed to Western acceptance of the notion that this was so. since, as this analysis has shown, the charge was without foundation and since the Chinese and Albanians were parties to the adoption of the long-range policy, their accusations should be seen as another element in a joint disinformation effort. The influence of ideology. The changes in the economic, political, and diplomatic practice of the Soviet government, which have been described above, contributed to the belief in the West that the influence of ideology in the Soviet system had declined. This was not so. On the contrary, the changes and readjustments were calculated, controlled, and pragmatic. They did not touch the economic and political fundamentals of the regime. In fact, they contributed to the restoration and strengthening of ideology as compared with the Stalin period. Similarly, a not always consistently maintained moderation in the Soviet press line on the West and continuing emphasis on common interests between the communist and non-communist worlds did not indicate revisionism or an increase in Western or nationalist influences in the Soviet Union, but rather a tactical shift within the framework of the long-range policy. It is true that the new, educated, post-revolutionary generation that grew up in the Soviet Union, as in Eastern Europe, presented a largely silent challenge to the basic principles of the communist system and its ideology. There was strong latent anxiety and opposition, especially among intellectuals and young people, and a genuine, deep-rooted sense of nationalism among the Russian and other peoples of the Soviet Union hostile to the regime. The hostility of the young was aggravated by the repression to which the older generation had been subjected. This genuine opposition, and the decline in the influence of ideology that reached its nadir in the immediate post-Stalin years, presented the regime with a serious problem. It could either revert to mass repression on Stalinist lines or adopt a new, more flexible Leninist approach. Stalinist methods having clearly failed, Leninist methods were the obvious choice. The economic gap between the privileged new class and the workers and collective farmers was narrowed, the use of terror and repression was restricted, and more sophisticated methods were used to counter religious, nationalist, and Western influences. A more flexible, Leninist approach was adopted toward the lost, younger generation. Using the techniques of the NEP period, the regime managed to increase its prestige, relieve the internal crisis, and neutralize actual and latent internal opposition. The only real change in the ideological substance of the regime was its increased effectiveness. Among other factors that contributed to Western belief in the decline in the influence of ideology were, for example, the replacement of the dictatorship of the proletariat by the state of the whole people, the alleged degeneration of Soviet leaders from genuine revolutionaries into reformists and revisionists, the alleged growth of special interest groups in Soviet society, and the emergence of some kind of bourgeois middle class, the revival of de-Stalinization, the increased accessibility of Soviet scientists, writers, and other intellectual and cultural figures, the larger numbers of Soviet Jews allowed to immigrate, and Chinese and Albanian accusations of Soviet revisionism. According to the 1961 program of the CPSU, the dictatorship of the proletariat, in other words, the dictatorship of the Communist Party, had served its purpose. Point 15, the state of the whole people, was to be maintained until the complete victory of communism. Far from indicating a weakening of ideological party control, this new formula should be seen as part of the overall attempt to broaden the political base of the party and enhance its influence by giving it a more moderate and less exclusive image. The party retained its monopoly of power, policy, and ideas. The gulf between the Soviet and non-communist social systems in fact widened even while the myth of common interests between them was being propagated. Intolerance of any genuine, uncontrolled political opposition in the Soviet Union was and is as severe as ever. All actions inside and outside the country are carried out with direct or indirect references to the abiding principles of Leninism. Ideological and political considerations override national and economic considerations as never before. Any expectation of a genuine increase in revisionist, nationalistic, or Western influences on the regime is unrealistic, especially given present Western attitudes toward the system. Even less well-founded is the notion that Soviet leaders and party members are less ideologically motivated than before and have abandoned revolution for reformism and revisionism. Although to some extent the adjustments after 1958 were introduced under pressure from a discontented population, among whom the influences of ideology had suffered a genuine decline, those adjustments were also in line with the ideological long-range policy objectives to which all the leaders were committed. The up-and-coming younger generation of leaders like Shelepin, Polyansky, and Andropov were not and are not revisionists or Young Turks, as some Western commentators dubbed them. Shelepin's report and the KGB activity for which he and Andropov have been responsible demonstrate that they are zealous revolutionaries who are committed to an ideological Leninist policy and are qualified to take over the burden of power from the older generation because of their commitment to that policy and because of their achievements in implementing it. There are no liberals, moderates, or conservatives in the Soviet leadership. There are only communists whose actions are determined by the requirements of the long-range policy. They may take on a public guise of liberals or Stalinists, but only if required to do so by the presidium of the party in the interests of that policy. Equally unfounded is the notion that the professional strata of the Soviet Union are becoming less ideologically minded or more independent of the party. The fact is that, normally, leading officials, generals, scientists, and professional bureaucrats are party members who know that their well-being depends on their standing with the party and the government, and that they would suffer if the regime were to be weakened. In general, they are less skeptical about communist doctrine than they were in Stalin's years, since arrests among them are now unusual and take place only if they participate actively in opposition to the regime. They are in fact more loyal than before. They know that the authority of the party leadership is unchallengeable. Since everything is under the control of the party, there are no divisions between the party leadership and the professionals. If the professionals play a more important role in the implementation of policy, they do so under party control. It is erroneous to suppose that the professionals in any field can be independent politically, as they are in the West. They have significant influence, but no independence. Unofficial evidence that military and economic professionals or technocrats play an independent role in the policy-making process can be discounted. If some professionals resign or express critical views in the Soviet press or in contact with foreigners, it can be assumed that they are doing so on the instructions of the party. The adjustments in economic policy were not a response to pressure from economists, technocrats, or scientists, as is sometimes supposed, but were planned and implemented on the initiative and under the control of the party apparatus acting in accordance with the requirements of its ideological long-range policy based on NEP experience. The adjustments were not intended for the enrichment of individuals or groups, but for the enrichment and stabilization of the regime and the fulfillment of communist policy. The technocrats and other professionals have not lost their ideological zeal. They remain leading party officials who have simply received new assignments from the party. If any of them depart noticeably from communist norms of life or degenerate into middle-class revisionists, they are removed from their positions and replaced. Their ideological zeal is maintained through nonviolent purges, systematic ideological education, and strict party control. Soviet workers and collective farmers are not becoming middle class, as some observers like to think. The improvement in the lot of rank-and-file workers is still modest. They have a long way to go yet until they reach a decent standard of living. Furthermore, in Soviet conditions, the emergence of a middle class is impossible because the party has different objectives and, when necessary, intensifies the ideological struggle against middle-class philosophy and practice to exclude such developments from Soviet society. The major party and bloc documents of lasting significance, such as the record of the CPCU's 21st Party Congress, the Manifesto of November 1960, Khrushchev's report of January 6, 1961, and the 1961 program of the CPCU, confirmed the fundamental principles of the Soviet regime and its ideology, as well as the final ideological objectives of the Soviet Union and the bloc. These documents directed the communist movement to an intensification of the ideological struggle against alien ideologies domestically and externally. They called for more and better communist ideological education. The evidence does not support the conclusion that, despite these documents, the Soviet regime has been evolving into a less ideological and more conventional national system. On the contrary, it points to a deliberate decision by the regime to pursue its acknowledged ideological goals the more effectively by distracting Western attention from them. This it has sought to do by misrepresenting tactical, pragmatic shifts in its practices as fundamental and spontaneous, thereby projecting a false image of a system evolving in a direction opposite to its declared purposes. In planning and executing this misrepresentation, it has used the doctrine and historical experience of Lenin's NEP. The revival of de-Stalinization. Perhaps the most important technique used to project a moderate image of Soviet policy in the late 1950s and early 1960s was the revival of de-Stalinization and the related issue of revisionism. This can be seen, for example, in the appointment of Pervukhin as Soviet ambassador to East Germany in 1958, the replacement of Serov by Shelepin as chairman of the KGB. The renewed denunciation at the 22nd CPSU Congress in October 1961 of the anti-party group as Stalinists for their past role in the repressions, the revived criticism of Stalin himself for these repressions, and the removal of his body from the Lenin mausoleum, the special exploitation of the Molotov affair, and the display of differences in attitudes towards Stalin between the Soviet leaders on the one hand and the Albanians and Chinese leaders on the other. Pervukhin had been a member of the opposition to Khrushchev in June 1957. He was therefore identifiable in the West, though wrongly, as a hardliner. He was appointed as ambassador to East Germany at a time when the Berlin Crisis of 1958 was being prepared by the Bloc strategists. His appointment can be regarded as the first calculated attempt to provide the West with a plausible explanation of an international crisis being provoked by the influence of the hardliners within the Soviet system. In fact, the crisis was created within the framework of long-range policy, and the major spokesman on it was none other than Khrushchev himself. Serov's case was different in that he had long been a supporter of Khrushchev, but, as has already been explained, his notorious past involvement in repressions and his narrow-minded attitudes made him unsuitable for a leading role in the implementation of the new long-range policy. The background of Shelepin, a former leader of Soviet Youth, provided a useful contrast, which in turn contributed to Khrushchev's and Shelepin's liberal images. The renewed criticism at the 22nd Party Congress of the anti-party group of Molotov, Malenkov, Bulganin, Voroshilov, and others for their role in past repressions and of Pervukhin's resistance to the policy of reform were perhaps the most striking and persuasive instances of the calculated use of spurious destalinization. The issues involved have been settled with the ending of the power struggle and the establishment of a homogeneous team of leaders committed to a long-range policy. The display of differences between moderates and Stalinists was linked with the decision of the 22nd Party Congress on November 1, 1961, to remove Stalin's body from the Lenin mausoleum and rebury it in the Kremlin Wall. Another stage display was the conspicuous refusal by KGB bodyguards, in front of foreign diplomats and journalists, to allow Voroshilov to join other Soviet leaders on top of the Lenin mausoleum for the official parade in November 1961. One purpose of these staged displays of de-Stalinization was to create a favorable climate for the conversion of former internal enemies of the regime into active allies in the promotion of its long-range policy. Khrushchev in person had meetings with several children of the rehabilitated officials. In the effort to involve all sectors of Soviet society with the new policy, rehabilitation was extended outside the political field. Khrushchev had a well-publicized meeting with a thief who had been released from prison. The KGB was given a special role in rehabilitating former prisoners and returning them to the party ranks. The KGB helped such people to obtain apartments and jobs through its contacts in factories and other institutions. Those who were considered suitable were recruited by the KGB for political assignments. The explanation of the Molotov affair is more complicated and deserves detailed examination. According to official and semi-official accounts, Molotov used his appointment as ambassador to Mongolia to establish contact with the Chinese leaders. When the Soviet leaders found out about this liaison, Molotov was recalled and appointed in 1960 to be the chief Soviet representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in Austria. According to Satyakov, the chief editor of Pravda, and other communist leaders including Kuzinin, on the eve of the 22nd Party Congress in October 1961. Molotov circulated a letter to the members of the Central Committee of the CPSU criticizing the draft of the new party program as revisionist, non-revolutionary, and pacifist. Molotov allegedly knew that the Chinese leaders shared his views. Molotov was recalled from Vienna to Moscow at the time of the 22nd Congress, but he played no part in it. Shortly afterward, he returned to Vienna, where he was said to be under house arrest. A few days later, he was back in Moscow. On January 8, 1962, the Soviet Foreign Ministry announced that he would be returning to Vienna. Within days, this statement was withdrawn. There are many curious anomalies in this story. Molotov was sent to Mongolia by Khrushchev to isolate him and to lower his prestige in the Soviet diplomatic service. He was kept under surveillance there by informers controlled by General Dobrynin, chief advisor to the Mongolian Security Service and former head of the KGB Surveillance Directorate. Continuing unauthorized contact between Molotov and the Chinese would have been virtually impossible. If such contact had taken place and had been reported, it is most unlikely that Molotov would have been posted to the IAEA in Austria. Like Malenkov, Bulganin, and others, he would have been sent off to retirement in a small town in the Soviet Union. Moreover, misconduct of this kind on Molotov's part would have been made known as before to party members in a secret letter as further evidence of his anti-party behavior. This did not happen. There was no reference to Molotov in the confidential party explanation of the decisions of the Congress containing such criticisms. Furthermore, the criticisms attributed to him look most unlikely. The draft program was based on the decisions of the 81 Party Congress of November 1960, which ratified the new revolutionary bloc policy and strategy. For Molotov to have criticized the program on the grounds alleged would have made him a laughingstock within the communist movement. Molotov did, however, criticize Khrushchev's policy on the eve of the 21st Party Congress 2 years earlier, in January 1959. And this was stated in the confidential circular to party members in Moscow on the decisions of that Congress signed by Vladimir Ustinov, who had become a Moscow party secretary. Molotov's criticisms were described as a mixture of dogmatism and quotations from Lenin. This episode was not mentioned by Satyakov and in fact has never been disclosed to the public by the Soviet leadership. It is therefore reasonable to deduce that Molotov's actual criticisms in 1959 were modified and only disclosed at a time suited to meeting the needs of policy in 1961. It is also possible that use was made of Molotov in this way with his knowledge and consent. As a party member, he would have had no option but to agree. The unusual publicity given to Molotov's movements between Moscow and Vienna may well have been intended to attract Western attention to the affair at a time of alleged Sino-Soviet differences. In this connection, it should be noted that Satyakov, supported by Mikoyan and other speakers, accused Molotov of predicting political conflicts with imperialism that would mean war. Mikoyan accused Molotov of rejecting peaceful coexistence. Another party official said that Molotov was opposed to high-level diplomatic contacts between Soviet and Western leaders. Satyakov summed up with this emphatic statement, "We say to Molotov, no. The CBCU has done its best to guarantee peace for the USSR on the basis of the Leninist policy of peaceful coexistence." Clearly, this exposure of Molotov's alleged warmongering could have been intended to support the moderate image of the Soviet leadership and the sincerity of their interest in peaceful coexistence in détente, in contrast with the warmongering of Molotov and the Chinese leadership. Two further aspects of Satyakov's attack on Molotov should be mentioned. He accused Molotov, first, of trying to assume the role of an interpreter of Lenin, and second, of criticizing the new party program as pacifist and insufficiently revolutionary. Both these criticisms were to be used by the Soviets against the Chinese leaders, at first without naming them, but later explicitly. It can therefore be suggested that the Molotov affair was used to support the authenticity of the alleged differences between the Soviets and Chinese on the issue of peaceful coexistence. The conspicuous revival of the de-Stalinization issue at the 22nd Congress and Khrushchev's public attack on the Albanians apparently angered the Chinese to such an extent that Chou Enlai, the leader of the Chinese delegation, withdrew from the Congress. As has already been explained, the issues of revisionism and Stalin's distortions of communism had already been settled between the leaders of the communist bloc at the end of 1957. Because they had been settled, there was no foundation for differences between communist parties on them. The conclusion may therefore be drawn that the revival of the issues at the 22nd Congress was artificial and that the differences between the Soviet and the Albanian and Chinese parties on Soviet revisionism and Chinese and Albanian Stalinism were calculated and agreed within the terms and in the interests of the long-range policy. It should be noted that one of the objects of the display of differences was to add credibility to the notion of Soviet moderation and to present Khrushchev as a revisionist. The conclusion that the display was staged provides another argument for regarding the notion of Soviet moderation as unfounded. The position of Soviet scientists and other intellectuals. Extensive preparations were made by the Central Committee and the KGB in 1958-60 to use scientists, writers, and other intellectuals for political and disinformation purposes in accordance with the requirements of the new long-range policy. Point 17. This new approach to the intellectuals had its internal aspect. By seeking their collaboration in some form of political activity, the regime sought to forestall opposition from them. But it is with the external Strategic implications of the intellectuals' role in bringing influence to bear on Western public opinion and governments that the present chapter is concerned. Fadyev's posthumous advice to the Central Committee to use intellectuals for exerting influence, not for spying on one another, had been well taken and was put into effect. The use of scientists in particular as agents of influence and channels for disinformation involved certain changes in their status. The Central Committee apparatus and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as well as the KGB, developed closer relations with them. Many of them were given intelligence training individually and in schools. The regime, instead of keeping them in isolation at home as before, began to promote both their accessibility at home and their travels abroad with a view to widening and exploiting their contacts with Western scientists. The complaints of academicians Kapitsa and Sakharov and the biologist Jaras Medvedev about the difficulties encountered by Soviet scientists wishing to travel and meet their Western colleagues were incomplete and distract attention from the real grounds for complaint by Western and Soviet scientists alike, which lie in the use of these contacts by the Central Committee and the KGB for collecting intelligence, conveying disinformation, and exercising political influence. 18. In fact, the majority of Soviet scientists lend themselves willingly to intelligence work against foreign scientists because of the opportunities it gives them to increase their knowledge and advance in their careers. Like Fadyev, they find it in better taste to spy on foreign associates than on their Soviet friends and colleagues. The use of Soviet scientists as agents of influence and channels for disinformation entailed changes in Soviet practice over the disclosure of secret information. Although the most significant areas, especially the process of policymaking and the technique of its implementation, remained as secret as ever, certain aspects of Soviet science and society were opened up. The obsession with secrecy appeared less total than in Stalin's days. The greater accessibility of Soviet scientists made its own contribution to the impression of evolution in the Soviet system. More important, however, was the promotion through Soviet scientists of the notion of common interest between the Soviet Union and the West. The attendance of KGB agents, such as academicians Topchiev, Artobolevsky, and Khvostov, at international scientific conferences and their role in promoting the idea of the Soviet Union's common interest with the United States in avoiding nuclear conflict deserve the closest scrutiny for the bearing they may have had on American willingness to engage in strategic arms control and disarmament negotiations with the Soviet Union and the voluntary decision by the United States in the early 1960s. To surrender its nuclear superiority in the naive belief that if the Americans reduced the rate of development of their nuclear arsenal, the Soviets would do the same. As in the case of the scientists, the KGB's use of its expanded assets among Soviet writers, especially among those with well-known names, had its internal and external aspects. Shelepin's plans to introduce false opposition on Dzerzhinsky's lines found concrete expression in the controlled debates between the conservative and liberal writers, in which the main protagonists on both sides, Kochetov and Tvardovsky, were collaborating with the Central Committee and the KGB. This debate, together with the general increase in East-West cultural contacts, made a useful contribution to the myth of evolution. Objectives of strategic disinformation on Soviet evolution and moderation. The main external objective of strategic disinformation in the early 1960s on the evolution and moderation of the Soviet regime and its common interests with the West was to create a suitable climate for activists. Detente diplomacy by the Soviet Union and other communist states into condition favorable and erroneous Western responses to communist initiatives. The five specific aims of communist diplomacy were to undermine Western unity, induce the advanced industrial nations to contribute to the growth of the economic and military potential of the bloc by agreeing to increase East-West trade, grant long-term credits, and supply advanced technology. Distract Western attention from the growth in the military strength of the bloc and the Soviet Union in particular. Engage the West, especially the United States, in arms control and disarmament negotiations, with a view to swinging the military balance of power in favor of the communist bloc. Create favorable conditions for communist parties to form united fronts with socialists and trade unionists in the advanced countries and with nationalist movements in the developing countries. At home, the main objective of the adjustments to the regime and the exaggeration of their significance through disinformation was to create favorable conditions for the further construction of socialism and the eventual transition to communism by neutralizing internal opposition and securing a reduction in external pressure on the regime from the West. Subsidiary objectives of the revival of de-Stalinization were to provide a foundation for open reconciliation and cooperation between the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia without revealing the full extent of Yugoslavia's membership in the bloc and commitment to its long-range policy. Provide grounds for Soviet-Albanian and Sino-Soviet differences in preparation for the pursuit of coordinated, dual foreign policies by the Soviet Union and China. Support further disinformation operations concerning disunity and disarray in the world communist movement ostensibly brought about by the decline in the influence of ideology and the resurgence of independent nationalist tendencies in communist parties inside and outside the bloc.